conference is being recorded.
This is our ninth practical work on self group session, and I'm very happy to have almost everybody here. Tonight we are missing our co-host David, who called about the day before yesterday and told me he had a meeting with a nonprofit that he had to be at. And so we hope that he will be joining us in the latter part of the call from his cell phone. And in the meantime, we will get started with Harmless Whim, discussing that, and then moving on from Harmless Whim to One Small Habit. So Silverdale is here live on the phone with us. Mike Williamson, Diana, myself, somebody else. I can't see who.
Yeah, me.
Who's
yeah,
me?
Yeah, Leona.
Leona. Oh, great. Leona calling from Nanaimo in Canada. And thank you for joining us. So we can start in with our discussion with Harmless Whim. If anybody has done the exercise and the exploration in that, let's start with discussion of that exercise in our direct experience. Anybody on the line who's played with it, well, we give the people on the computer some time to perhaps type in responses.
Hey, T.
Yes.
I've got two questions on exercises, one from Search for Dr. Livingstone and one from Harmless Whim.
Go ahead and start in with that.
Okay. On the Search for Dr. Livingstone, my understanding of the exercise was to say, I'm not a CPA. But I started struggling, and let me explain what happened.
Okay.
I thought I was supposed to sort of disavow all mechanicalities and personality functions, and I think I got confused because I started going, I'm not a CPA, and sort of like chanting that to myself. And then I started going, okay, I'm not frustrated, or I'm not tired, or I'm not depressed. And what I became was completely confused.
Yes, that's denial.
Can you sort of help me with what I should have done or where I went awry? Because I think I don't completely understand this exercise.
So in the practical work on self, the object is not to annihilate or get rid of or go away from what we are, but to relax our identification with it so that we understand and experience directly that we're more than those things. So I think a better exercise for you, rather than I am not this and I am not that, might be I am this and I am also that and I am also that and I am also that. It's really the same exercise in the same way we spoke of last week with the Sufi exercise or Sufi sound practices, the male version, nothing exists except God, the female version, God is love, lover, and beloved. Remember we spoke about that and you were thinking about that. In the same way, either creating an emptiness by being none of those things, or a fullness by being all of those things and many more things, some of which you haven't discovered, will really lead you to a very similar result at this particular stage in the work. Is this okay. Useful?
I think so. It makes a little bit more sense, and I'd like to explore this with our private sessions.
Okay. So in the meantime, there's a difference between trying to move away from a part of yourself and embracing that part fully and accepting it with the understanding that you can identify with your non-phenomenal self rather than your, as Silverdale puts it, your historical personality. So rather than rejecting it to the point where you're trying to get rid of it, if you can look at it, embrace it, and kind of move larger than that by relaxing it, then that would be, in my understanding, more in keeping with the exercise. Silverdale, do you have an opinion about this?
Yes, I do, T. You know, as I mentioned last week, everything in this book is predicated on, even if falsely, the assumption that you have already mastered everything that Gurdjieff wrote. There are a lot of people, I'm sure, who have read E.J.'s books and have maybe never heard of Gurdjieff or only heard of him indirectly, so all of this, none of this would be apparent to them. But what Gurdjieff the groundwork that Gurdjieff lays is something like this. Every one of us, without exception, possesses what he would call a particle of divinity, which is uncreated. That is, we're a part of the absolute before the absolute created creation. When the absolute creates creation, he puts his threefold nature into the creation, so we become triune beings experiencing time and space. This is important to accept or recognize because these three forces are separate, they're independent, they're autonomous, they're diverse, they're co-equal, and of course they're diametrically opposite. So during the course of our ordinary life, we only develop one of these three forces, what I call the historical personality, and we are all those things, Diana, that you talked about, and to escape any one of those things is virtually impossible. So what this exercise, The Search for Dr. Livingston and Harmless Whim, and what we'll be talking about tonight, One Small Habit, are really trying to develop a second part of ourselves that we're normally not aware is a part of ourselves. And that second force, I call it, or that second force is experience. If we were fully developed in that second force, what we would be experiencing is light in infinite extension, clear light in infinite extension, which would give to us a sense of undifferentiated unity of everything. And whatever we looked at or thought about ourselves would only be as though we were sitting in a movie theater watching something that had nothing to do with us other than the fact that we're watching it. And so the question is how do we develop that second part of ourselves, experiencing ourselves as undifferentiated, clear light in infinite extension? And then Gurdjieff's recommendation for that is, well, initially you have to pretend that it already exists, you end up saying, I'm nothing more than clear light and infinite extension. And then once you have that second force mature within yourself, then you combine it with that first force, your historical personality, and that third force of personal beingness begins to develop, and this over, of course, a period of time. So anyway, The Search for Dr. Livingston. Can you imagine yourself to be nothing more than white light in infinite extension, which is already a part of who you are? It's just that it's atrophied because you've never used that. And the way you strengthen it is by pretending for a moment it actually already exists in you, and you're only realizing it after the fact.
Huh. So, Silverdale, when you first started this work and you were trying to, like you said, with both the chapters we just went through with Dr. Livingston and with Harmless Whim, when you were meditating, and you were a beginner like I am right now because you know I'm a beginner, were you able to focus on this light and call in the light while you were simultaneously, much like T just said, I am this and I am also that? So were you sort of summoning the light while you recognized, you know, I am, I also have an aspect of me of that's angry or it's attached to being a CPA or being an attorney or whatever it is? I mean, were you trying to create merger? Tell me how you started this.
Well, first of all, Diane, because of my unique circumstances in 1992, what I decided, which was when I first read the book, In Search of the Miraculous. Are you familiar with that book at all?
I'm not.
Okay. In Search of the Miraculous was written by a student of Gurdjieff who summarizes very nicely the totality of everything that he learned from Gurdjieff over a period of maybe 10 years before he subsequently rejected Gurdjieff altogether. But that doesn't diminish from the value of that book. That is a hugely invaluable introduction to Gurdjieff's overall thought. Subsequently, Gurdjieff, in the aftermath of a personal car accident that nearly killed him, decided to write everything he write his system down in a trilogy. So, and that trilogy is like a million-piece jigsaw puzzle that has been put into three different books and shaken up. And then what Gurdjieff says to the interested reader, put this jigsaw puzzle back together, this million-piece jigsaw puzzle back together, and you will see what I'm trying to communicate. Mm-hmm. So in my case, to do that, I became a security guard, and I worked 80 hours a week, and it took me 3 years at 60 hours a week in order to master that trilogy and understand more or less exactly what Gurdjieff was getting at and what his objective was. So what I'm sharing with you is kind of my conclusions, what Gurdjieff is saying. And then what I discovered with EJ in these books, Human Biological Machine, Practical Work on Self, Seven Bodies of Man, Visions in the Stone, all that stuff is nothing more than Gurdjieff's kind of the next level of application of what Gurdjieff has laid down. So now back to your question. How does all this happen? Just accept it from somebody who knows. You consist of three different co-equal and diametrically opposite forces. Over the course of your lifetime or over the course of any of our lifetime, we only allow one of these three forces to grow and develop. I call that the historical personality, your sense of from the moment you were conceived through all the stages of your life to the moment you take your last breath. But there are two other co-equal forces, and if they're not developed and educated, then they atrophy, and they have no will, or you can't really bring them into motion. And so the exercise here is simply this. Just believe it. Gurdjieff says you have to lie to yourself initially until it actually becomes a reality. You might say to yourself, look, what I really am is not a historical personality, although clearly I am a historical personality. What I really am, my essential self, my non-phenomenal self, is infinite light, clear light and infinite extension, experiencing undifferentiated unity, and you would experience this personally over, you know, it took me several years to finally get the hang of it. You experience that undifferentiated unity as a pleasant vibratory sensation, and the way you know if you're experiencing it is either you're experiencing something pleasurable or you're not experiencing anything at all. And over time, it's just like an infant. It has to be attended to daily, and it gradually does grow over a fairly long period of time. And once that second force is educated and matured, you know, to a degree, then you learn to blend that second force with the first force, and that produces, well, a state called enlightenment, or you know, what would be the equivalent of it. That's my understanding anyway.
Okay, I'd like to make an interjection.
Yeah.
That's great in terms of a horizon view or an overview looking from a distance above the situation. In the moment, since we're working with harmless whim, coming back to the first chapter, although we can never really stop an automatic manifestation of the machine till we're able to exert the will to awaken the machine, the effort, although guaranteed to fail, can serve as a reminding factor to activate the attention And at the same time, we can use the inevitable feelings of frustration to help us awaken the machine. So what happens, Diana, is that we bump up against our frustration in even the questions that you're asking, but as you thrash around in there trying to figure out what's you and what isn't you and what to relax and what to emphasize, you're in that process, you're activating your attention, and even the frustration can be of service to you to begin to make the shifts that ultimately lead into what Silverdale is talking about. Hello? Uh-oh, do we have sound?
And of course, there's that thing about, you know, we are working with the, I mean, we're not alone in this, and what seems to be our anger or our fear or our pain is actually, it's just as much everyone else's too, in a sense.
Okay, I'm back on.
Great. That's a good point, Mike. So to take up where we left off, I was saying that's a great overview, Silverdale, that you gave us. And to integrate that with where Diana is at, I believe, at this point, coming back to Harmless Whim in the first page, although we can never really stop an automatic manifestation of the machine until we're able to exert the will to awaken the machine, the effort, although guaranteed to fail, can serve as a reminding factor to activate the attention. And at the same time, we can use the inevitable feelings of frustration to help us to awaken the machine. So, Diana, when we're struggling with trying to wake up and we feel frustrated, even the thrashing around trying to determine, is this part of me? Is this not a part of me? Who am I? What am I? All the Dr. Livingston work is part of that frustration that develops some of the attention and force of will in order to begin to awaken the machine very gradually. And over time, we accumulate enough in the piggy bank of our attention to begin going through the types of shifts that Silverdale has been describing to us. Does this make sense?
On some level, not completely, but it makes me think about the struggle with two sorcerers. I'm just thinking that this internal struggle that at least I'm now attentive to is probably the beginning phase of everything that we've been talking about, you know, what Silverdale talked about and what I've been learning from this course. I'm assuming at this point the attentiveness to the struggle is probably good. Does that make sense?
It's excellent, and I have just a bit more to say about that. One of our clients, or my clients who listens on the internet, or one of our internet people, was telling me today how frustrated she was with the work and that she would tend to dissociate and shut down and get very resistant to doing it at all. And when I asked her what was happening with that, what was her process around it, was happening with it that as she began to wake up a little bit, she was aware that she was asleep. And because she's a little bit of a perfectionist, it was, and she actually recorded her commentary about this, which she said I could share with you tonight, but I don't know the technology of that, so I'm okay talking about it. So she said that she got so frustrated with her awareness of being asleep that she would feel like quitting or giving up. And what I told her is that she's aware now of she's not in the deep, the sleep of the, she's aware of the sleep of the sleep, and she's awake to the sleep. and being awake to the sleep and knowing that you're asleep and struggling with it and watching the ways that you even resist the awareness that you're asleep because it's frustrating because you can't simply just wake up. That's that struggle of sorcerers, and that's that frustration that creates this energy and develops the will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really important beginning place.
Okay, that makes sense.
Is that helpful?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Good, okay. Any more commentary on this topic?
Well, the only thing I was going to sort of talk, and it stays in mind, talking about like harmless whim. I tried to be attentive to honoring two whims. One that I think was, I was searching to relieve pain. Another, I was searching for pleasure. Tonight, I was actually searching for pleasure. And I was craving my favorite meal, which I cook when I need to nurture myself. And I cooked it, and I felt satisfied and calmer, but that was a temporary feeling. And the same thing occurred a while ago. I was obsessing about an issue in my neighborhood, and I mean obsessing. And when I resolved the issue, again, I calmed down, only to find I was then obsessing about another issue.
Okay, so what does that have to do with the harmless whim? How are you? You seem to be relating that, and I'm not quite certain.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How that's connecting with it?
Okay, let me explain what I think is happening, and tell me if I'm right. I was thinking, okay, so a harmless whim was I'm craving a certain food. Because it invokes a certain feeling in me when I eat this food. So I cook this food because it was my way of nurturing myself and pacifying myself. So I felt temporarily pacified, but I knew I was temporarily pacified, and then I knew at some point I'd be looking for something else. So in my mind, I assumed I had done what EJ talked about, which is satisfy a harmless whim.
Okay. That's not what he means by harmless whim. It's a good piece of self-observation, and you're watching yourself, and that attention is very helpful to your process. But that's not the harmless whim method, which that's why we're talking about it, to try and clarify that. Now, I did get an email today. I had emailed David and asked him for his take on harmless whim so that we could include that this evening. And I'd like to read that if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Harmless whim, the purpose is to find an exercise to develop will. The method is to adopt a harmless whim that is not our own, not a part of our mechanical repertoire. This we may copy from another. We may observe a gesture, a vocal phrase, etc., and we adopt it. This is an actor's trick in learning how to portray another's character. That adopted whim must be harmless. In Chapter 9, One Small Habit, we struggle with an unremitting habit of the machine. The struggle is with observation of that mechanicality. The smaller the better. So that's very similar. And we'll come back to that. There's a little more commentary on his part. So as he told us last week or the week before, as the different exercises begin to take a different slice of the orange at a slightly different angle, all in order to have the aim of developing the will of attention and the attention of will, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, it does.
Okay, so in the harmless whim, the attention gathering exercise is to observe something that isn't something that you normally do, and to try to pick something that the machine doesn't have an attachment to. So what you chose was something that the machine has an attachment to, so you're not really importing something that works the attention in a new way. And harmless whim is to work the attention in a new way as an exercise.
I.e., I would start stroking my beard like Mike did.
Yeah.
If I had a beard, I would start stroking my beard.
Okay, well, if you don't have a beard, you can certainly copy that mannerism, and that would certainly be an excellent harmless whim.
I got it.
Then it would be a meditation, in a sense, of what it feels like and what you're presencing if, for somebody who actually does that. You're identifying with something that's outside of the machine and finding out what it would be like to run that particular software, which you don't quite relate to, and that stretches the identity and exercises the identity and helps you to get out of the identity box a little bit.
Okay. Can you tie this back to the comment you made about increasing attention to will and will of attention? So let's say I adopt this new habit and I start stroking my chin.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm creating, help me a little bit with this attention to will and will of intention.
The attention to will is... Each of the exercises is a different form of attention to will. You're taking the exercises, which at some point we will cull from the chapters, and I will copy in some form for everyone and email and also put on the website. So each exercise is an attention to will, where you're developing your attention and you're developing your will by focusing your attention a little bit differently. So if you're focusing your attention on the harmless whim, which is importing something into your identity, if you're focusing your attention into discovering identity, if you're focusing your attention into what your personal habits are, if you're focusing your attention, like in the pond exercise, to the things that trigger you, if you're focusing your attention to the negative manifestations of other people or our own negative manifestations, all these types of exercises begin to hone the will and begin to gather force for the work by keeping your attention on things that you don't normally focus on with a specialized form of attention. The will to attention is... it's almost like setting your intention to develop your attention.
Oh. Okay.
And you can see how those two things fit together. When you develop an intention, your intention is to wake up, right? And you have to gather your attention in order to begin to awaken yourself. So as you do that, then you use the exercises to begin to create a focus around that intention.
Okay. That helps.
All right. Silverdale, do you have more commentary on any of that? If he's with us.
I know, I was waiting for him. He always talks about these three forces. I was waiting for him to tie that together.
I have another question for him at some point. I believe he's his...
Teresa, I ended up getting cut off for a little while, so he might be just cut off. Like I was.
I'll tell you what I did was I muted my phone so I could listen and then type in what I wanted to say. And so that's what I'm doing.
Oh, okay. Would you prefer for me to read it rather than having you speak it?
You know, it, it, it I'd like to try that out for just this one thing. So give me a minute to finish typing, and I'll send it out, and we'll see how that works.
All right. Now, in the meantime, do we have any other whims that people have tried, our Voyagers have tried in the course of the week, or any experiences working with Harmless Whim or insights about the chapter?
When I read the chapter, it's Leona. When I read the chapter today, I thought back on the last week of my life and thought about had I had any experiences of what this was seemed to be talking about. And as I'm listening to you, I'm getting a different kind of take on it. But I thought that a harmless whim. What I was practicing was saying and speaking something that I would not necessarily have ever done before.
Yes, that's in the spirit of it, as I understand it. So what was your experience with that?
It was freeing. Totally freeing in order to, like, after I... allowed myself to do that a few times. It felt really, really good, actually.
What did you do those few times?
I was in a situation which I would not necessarily have ever spoken the way that I did, and I did. Like I did something totally different and different than my general usual interaction was with this person.
So that was a new experience that gave you some stretching room within your identity.
Yes.
Good. Any other whims that people have played with over the last week? No. Okay.
I'm getting it. I'm getting it. When you're talking, though, I'd like to hear more about what you're saying, because it's like it's not quite clear.
Okay, I'll have you ask a question about that in a moment. And I just saw Silverdale post his comment. I'd like to read that first, and we can come back to your question. Only by consciously and intentionally directing an action, such as a whim, which is different to the natural mechanical habits of the historical personality, can a faint taste of the will of the non-phenomenal self be experienced. So, Leona, what is your question that you would like to have clarified?
Non-phenomenal self. What is that? Mean.
The non-phenomenal self is the being, as you will. It's the part of you that is not your personality or your historic self or your mechanicality. It's a part of you that exists outside of phenomena.
Okay.
Teresa, can I give that definition from the invocation of presence?
Please.
E.J. writes, presence is the only discernible something which is non-phenomenal.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, of course, that presence is going to be based on whole body attention or whole body awareness and as well as sensing the sleep of the machine, those sorts of things.
That's right. So the exercises are designed to develop that presence through attention.
Well, I think what we find, what all of us find very difficult to believe, because we have so little experience with it, is that what we really are is clear light in infinite extension. And we can ask the question, well, why, if that's such a real part, if that is an actual part of ourselves, why don't we experience it? Well, the reason is nobody tells us about it when we're young. We're not educated as to how to lift weights to develop those muscles. And because, of course, you know, we just develop a historical personality that gets swept downstream. And practical work on self is, as you were saying earlier, T, different exercises by which we can strengthen our awareness that what we really are is our non-phenomenal self, and our real non-phenomenal self, which has its own intelligence and ways of communicating, clear light and infinite extension, undifferentiated unity with everything. And that's what practical work on self is, developing the strength through education of that non-phenomenal self, which produces will. And then we become really unusual.
And you had also added on the internet, over time these experiences accumulate, producing a residue called will.
Right. And that comes about through seeking simply to pacify the historical personality and not do it actively and overtly. I'm going to actively pacify my personality. I'm just going to observe it. And in my observation of it, it will gradually become pacified itself. And then, as it states in the chapter tonight, One Small Habit, in that pacification process, the essential self automatically begins to grow because it's not being vampirized by the historical personality.
Can you tell us a little bit more how you're using the word pacification in this context?
Yeah. Pacification is doing nothing, by which I mean, look, at all of us are moving through life by momentum. From the moment of our conception, when we experienced our own Big Bang in miniature, our personal universes have been expanding and will continue to expand until we take our last breath. And in that expanding universe, we are experiencing division, multiplication, and diversification. We see this in the physical body. We see it in our mind and the thoughts we have, and we see it in our feelings, and we see it changing over the course of our lifetime. We're not going to change the Big Bang that has already occurred, but what we can do is do nothing. And again, doing nothing is simply, when I say do nothing, pacification of the historical body means, according, you know, in accordance with Gurdjieff's ideas, simply observing yourself. Hey, look at that. I just lost my temper. Hey, look at that. I just stopped the car. Hey, look at that. I just sneezed. Hey, look at that. Look what I just did. That's pacification of the historical personality, even though you're not actively attempting to stop anything. And as you begin to say that, hey, look what I just did. I lost my temper, or I just laughed, or I just drank a glass of water. I just made a reservation in a restaurant. All those things. With that becomes the pacification of the historical personality over time, and with that the proportionate increasing of your awareness of what you really are is clear light and infinite extension, undifferentiated unity. And with that comes a certain pleasant sensation. And gradually you shift your center of gravity of who you know yourself to be away from your historical identity, personality, to, hey, I'm a non-phenomenal being who's manifesting in this physical body.
So could you say that as you begin to develop the habit, consistent habit of self-observation without resisting the automatic manifestations of the machine,
that's
and
right.
without resisting the struggle, but observing the struggle, then
right.
you have a much better fighting chance to experience the clear light, because you're not so tangled up in all of those processes, and you're with yourself. You're present with it instead of trying to escape it through the mechanicalities.
See, that is very well spoken, and I just edit that word struggle. We're not struggling with our historical personality. What we are is the benevolent, all-merciful, all-forgiving, all-loving, absolute, who embraces our historical personality just because it realizes we couldn't have been anything other than what we are, and so, you know, we have complete compassion for who we are, and that is the growth and development of that non-phenomenal part of ourselves.
That's on the other side of it. Like with the client I was speaking about earlier, on the side of it when you're starting, because there's a tendency to judge and dismiss and even condemn the historical self, and that creates the buffers, then it's difficult to be present and then with ourselves, and then there's struggle. And as we begin to be able to engage in impartial self-observation, then we move into what you're discussing as a later phase of development.
Okay, very, very good. Very well spoken.
Thank you. Is that making sense to you, Leona?
Yes. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Great. So, any other questions or discussions about Harmless Whim?
No, but T. Silverdale, thank you for that last conversation. I like the way T. you tied all that together at the end. That was very helpful.
Good. I'm trying to interface between the beginning experience and the more experienced experience so that people who are listening and engaging can begin to make that shift and relate to it in a way that's practical. So,
good point.
Given that we have a few minutes before we need to change the tape, and we'll go into the next chapter when we change the tape, I'd like to ask you, Silverdale, since you're present, you mentioned in our last group something about the law of seven, which you didn't have time to let us know what that was, and there may have been some interest in that. I'm certainly interested myself. Would you be willing to tell us a little bit about the law of seven?
Yes, and because in order for these three forces, in order for these three forces to work together harmoniously, it's imperative to understand how this law of seven operates. How this law of seven operates. Now, the best way to envision or imagine what I'm about to say is this. The octave in music was intentionally created in order to explain to future generations how the law of seven operates, which is to say, hold on just a moment while I formulate this.
Take your time. They're always worth waiting for.
Okay, let me start here. Why did the Absolute, when he existed, and again, you know, when she existed,
existed.
The Absolute, when she existed entirely by herself in the universe, in the void, realized that gradually the primary residence of her existence would be diminished by the flow of time. That is, she was going to eventually run out of energy. She decided to modify these two laws that maintained herself. And those two laws that maintained herself was the law of three and the law of seven. And by modifying these two laws, the now existing creation sprung into existence all in one moment. So what we're really dealing with here is one gigantic frozen thought in which everything has happened, which is, that's a gigantic thought all by itself. The reason I explain that, though, is for this reason. In order for the absolute to feed herself, she would give life to the creation, and then she would get that life back from the process of reciprocal feeding and maintenance. The reason that's important is that the three forces, active, passive, and reconciling. And these three forces can be manipulated in different ways for different purposes, depending upon what your personal aim is. And we're trying to manipulate those three forces for our own self-perfecting and transformational evolution.
Yes.
Now, the law of seven, the absolute, modified in this way. And now you think of an octave on a piano. C, D, E, C, a sharp note, a D sharp note, E, and then no sharp note, F, right?
Yes.
That's called an interval. And then, of course,
another
F
way,
sharp.
Excuse me, that's a little clearer for some to understand it. Half step, whole step, half step, half step, half step, whole step.
That's exactly right, T. Now, that the reason that's important is this. Before the modification of that law of seven, there were no half notes. Everything was a whole note, and everything happened harmoniously without any outside force being introduced into each of these three forces.
And therefore no dissonance?
And therefore no dissonance, exactly right. So what the absolute did was he modified three. There were three modifications to that law of seven. The lower interval, where there's no sharp note, allows for the inflow of something from the outside in order to maintain that force. She lengthened it. In order to permit the inflow of forces from the outside. The note at the top, that top interval, she shortened, requiring each individual unit to intentionally actualize that interval. And by lengthening one interval and shortening another one, there was a dissonance created in the middle, as it turns out, which, I'm sorry to have to make that. I don't want to make this complicated. It's not complicated once you kind of get it all. But I'm saying, this law of seven is just like each of these three forces is subject to the law of seven, which has three modified aspects to it. One that allows for the inflow of outside forces from the other two forces. One shortened, requiring each of us to individually actualize, and then a third one, which is disharmonized unless it proceeds in complete silence and stillness, which is an acquired ability. And
so these are different frequencies, and these frequencies have different qualities of consciousness associated with them that we all have access to use for our development of awareness.
Exactly right, T. That's exactly right, and that's how those three forces work together. It becomes like playing chords in a melody, chords with one hand, and a melody with the other hand, and then you're creating your own personal music, and you're balancing one force, which is undifferentiated, clear light and infinite extension. You're balancing your participation, the participation of your historical personality in time and space, and your creating indestructible being, which is your return to that particle of divinity from which you originally sprung.
Good. Okay. Two things. For pause, I would like to know if there's a book you can recommend about the Law of Seven, and in just a few minutes, then we'll probably need to pause to change the tape.
Right. You know, the best book is that book, In Search of the Miraculous, by P.D. Uspensky. In Search of the Miraculous, and the author's last name is spelled O-U-P-E-N-S-K-Y. I'll type that in here. But anyway, that is really the best introduction to the overall topic. And then, of course, Uspensky understood it. Well, maybe not. Uspensky does a good job of summarizing it, and it's a great introduction to the subject.
So,
but that Gurdjieff, he knew what he was talking about.
So I think this is both background for and theory for understanding the origins of practical work on self, as well as more advanced understanding, because it just depends how far one takes it. And E.J. Gold has elaborated the work in a way that's practical and accessible, but this theory can be useful to some beginners of a certain bent and become more useful as people develop along the path.
That's right.
So,
thank
you. So this being said, let's change the tape now and reconvene in just a moment. Are they ready to do that on the other end there? Do we have some way of alerting?